Sitting or standing?
I'm gonna sit, I think. However, I would like to get started, so maybe I'll stand up to provide a more better. Powerful presence. Folks, welcome to this discussion.
Hey.
Ariel, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jerry.
Of possibilities for getting out of the fossil fuel trap that we're in. And I will close that. The general consensus on the left, and certainly in the Green Party, is that if we just did renewables on a sufficiently large scale, we'd solve the problem. What I want to suggest to you is that the cost of that is so large that it won't solve the problem for about 1.5 billion people who have no electricity whatsoever, and the kind of things that are being talked about aren't going to provide that. And it's my sense is that that matters, that if we're going to go forward into the future that we're trying to create here, it's everybody's in it. Everybody's together. Nobody's out in left field because they can't get resources. So that's a political position, but it's mine. And so I'll be talking a little bit about one possibility, which is getting energy from the moon, solar energy from the moon instead of from the planet. Now I realize as soon as I say moon, people immediately begin thinking about werewolves or moonstruck or baying at the moon, and one loses all sense of we might be actually have to have a committed serious discussion here. So, but that's what it is. It's a serious proposal for essentially getting the source of our energy out of our ecosystem almost entirely. And I'll get to that, okay? So that was just kind of, hi, here I am, this is sort of what we're going to talk about. Let me sit down and I'll begin talking about it. Since I've been here, two people have come up to me, we're here at the meeting, wanting to talk about other possibilities, other than the two I had in mind. And really, what I'm hoping to do with this conversation is to open up that sense that this isn't a solved problem out there. We don't have the answer if they just did what we said. This is something which still requires thinking and figuring out as to where we're going to go. One of the suggestions was to use nuclear power developed by lithium fluoride reactors. These are reactors which are molten salt. And if things fail, what happens is the salt solidifies and everything stops. So it's much safer. And also, the materials are cheaper, much more available. They're actually a byproduct of the production of some of the rare earth metals that you have in your cell phone. So there's lots of good reasons to look into that as a possibility. Someone else mentioned, why don't we just grow more trees? Do carbon, sequestering. It's certainly the case that if you transform the soil, it will in fact absorb more carbon and makes the soil more fertile. And there are ideas out there for simultaneously transforming our agriculture and sequestering some of the carbon dioxide that's in the air. There's another possibility, which, again, I'm not going to talk about in any great detail. Yes, and your name is?
Steve Schauer.
So talk with Steve if you
want to
talk about those things. And he's got a little handout for you all. There's another one which was actually suggested by the Secretary of Energy a while back. He's no longer Secretary of Energy. He was a Nobel Prize winning physicist. And so you would think it would have some weight. And it's basically, paint your roof white. Increase the reflectance of the planet by a black roof absorbs almost all the energy on it. A perfectly white roof would reflect it all, but you don't get it all the way, but you can get whiter than you've got. And by doing that, some of the radiation that would be absorbed in heat actually gets sent back out into space. I'm told that in Los Angeles, it is now a law that any public building has to have its roof painted white. Its roof painted white. Why that hasn't caught on more, I don't know. It seems to me also something that can be done in short term. Again, it's the politics that gets in the way. We can't agree on it. We can't get clear about what we need to do.
Yes. This is a very selfish reason for choosing light-colored roofing. Also, and that's to reduce your own utility.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All that heat that gets reflected out to space, it didn't go into your heating bill.
Right.
It's a very good idea. You wouldn't have to paint all that large a proportion of the roofs white in the world before you would fix the problem. The problem being, well, let me get into that. Let me still talk about what is the fossil fuel trap? Why are we talking about this? So, we've been using fossil fuels as the main part of our energy, and I'll show you in just a minute just how much of our energy is fossil fuels still. And as a consequence, we've been using fuels that were created over millions of years, and we're releasing the carbon dioxide into the atmosphere in 100 years. If we keep on doing it, the atmosphere will just keep warmer and warmer. I assume I'm talking to believers here, that this is something you all know, and I'm just sort of,
I don't know anything.
You don't? Okay, well, as a physics professor.
I never took physics.
That's all right. I have a slide here at the end, which I hope someone might ask for. Let me show it to you. Yes.
I don't know a lot about it either, and that's why I'm here, because I thought this is very interesting. You hear people talk a lot about this, about energy, finding new sources of energy, so I'm curious.
Yeah, okay, so I'll give it to you. I mean, around a little after the turn of the century, a fellow by the name of Arrhenius, who was a Swedish chemist, calculated what the temperature of the Earth would be if it was just a ball with no atmosphere on it, and he assumed it would absorb whatever radiation it got. It would be about minus 5 degrees centigrade, the average temperature. That water would be frozen. Now, because we have an atmosphere, that isn't the answer. The radiation that would ordinarily be let me back up a little bit. So there's a balance, right, between the sunlight coming in, right, and the radiation of the planet radiating back into space. Now, if there's more coming in than going out, the temperature goes up. When the temperature goes up, the radiation into space increases. You know, if you heat a piece of metal, right, after a while you can see it. It starts glowing, right? You're seeing light radiation coming out of it. But long before that, there's radiation you can't see, infrared radiation, which is coming off the thing. And the hotter it gets, the more of that there is, right? So what happens is, the sun's radiation is pretty much constant. Some people will tell you that the climate change is being caused by changes in the sun's radiation. That's simply false. The data is all there. It's simply false. So the radiation comes in, it's constant. and the planet warms up until the radiation leaving is the same as the radiation coming in. And then that's the temperature it stays at. Right? You put a piece of metal out in the hot sun, let it sit there for a while, it gets hot. Right? You pick it up, you know that it's hot. Right? You put it in a room with no more sunlight, it cools back down again, it radiates a little bit. Well, what happens with carbon dioxide? So the culprit here is not just carbon dioxide, but what are called greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases are gases that are absorbent to radiation in the infrared. That is to say, radiation that would have escaped into space, but doesn't, because it gets picked up again in the atmosphere. So the picture is, oh, goodness gracious. Oh, I see that. So the picture is...
You went to one too many clicks. One back up one. There.
There we go. Okay, now we go way into that. So here's the sunlight coming in, right? Some of that bounces off the clouds and goes back out. That's good for keeping us cool, right? Some of it gets reflected. That's what I'm talking about in terms of white roofs, right? Just send it right back out. But most of it gets absorbed by the Earth, and it comes in wavelengths that we can see, and it gets radiated back out in wavelengths that we can't see, infrared. Now, some of that just goes through the atmosphere. But if you have gases in the atmosphere which absorb, well, the clouds can also re-radiate heat and absorb heat, but that's not what I'm talking about. If you have gases in the atmosphere which can absorb the infrared, they'll radiate it. The sun will go this way, but a lot will go this way. And so the heat that was leaving can't leave. It's like putting a blanket on yourself when you're sleeping and it's too cold outside to go to sleep. You know how it keeps you awake? It does me, anyway. So you put a blanket on, and what happens is that air between you and the blanket comes to a temperature closer to your body temperature and not so much the temperature outside. So this layer of CO2, it's actually throughout the atmosphere, the images this way, and also methane, is like a blanket on the Earth. It's keeping us warm. And the thicker you make the blanket, the warmer you get, which is what's happening. We have, I'm told this is the 14th hottest month ever. And people in Houston will surely believe it, yes?
Yes, the polar ice caps are shrinking and they're white. They're collecting off a lot of energy.
Yes.
Has anybody calculated what percentage of that energy is going to change when the polar ice caps
yes.
are gone?
Yes. What you're speaking to are what are called feedback effects. Mm-hmm. So the ice melts because the air around is getting warmer because of this effect. When the ice melts, ice is a very good reflector. You get less of it. So there's less being reflected into the atmosphere and more being absorbed into the Arctic Ocean to contribute to the rise in temperature of the planet. That's a positive feedback loop. And the real danger in all of this is that these positive feedback loops are going to take over and the whole thing is going to change. It's going to change dramatically, and it's going to change in such a short period of time that we're going to have great difficulty adjusting to it as a civilization. There are feedback loops in both directions, but the ones that you're really concerned about are these positive feedback loops. There's another one, which is as the Arctic tundra melts, there's methane in the tundra. The methane goes up into the atmosphere, makes it worse. So more Arctic tundra melts. You see the problem.
It's also affecting the ocean's global current. It's oil, and it may actually shut it down.
That's correct. That's one of the things that can happen when the patterns change. There's something called basins of attraction for systems like we're talking about, which are chaotic. they sort of bounce around, you know, they bounce around, but they bounce around within a sort of confined region of the variation of parameters, the variation of temperatures, pressure, and so on. The flow of the currents is more or less the same, you know, it varies a little bit, but it's more or less the same. The jet stream is more or less the same. Well, the jet stream in the northern hemisphere and the jet stream in the southern hemisphere, for the first time, as far as we know ever, linked up recently. Major change in the pattern of the flow of what's happening. The worst possible outcome, but not entirely unlikely, is an end state where all these positive effects keep on going and keep on putting more and more stuff into the atmosphere. It just gets hotter and hotter, and you wind up with something like Venus, which is too hot, like 700 degrees on the surface, for anything to live. This was about 2 years ago. I saw an estimate of the probability of us getting to that state if we do nothing. It was about 1/3.
Ooh,
1/3. 1/3. 1/3 that we would wind up in that state and be able to do nothing about it. It would just be a runaway thing that we couldn't stop anymore. Now, nothing much has happened.
An estimate from whom?
Yeah, I don't remember. Okay. It was people. The people who make those kind of estimates do complicated models of the atmosphere. They try to put in as much of the physics as they can. They try to make it as accurate as they can. They try to get the biggest possible computer to be able to let them do that. And I don't remember exactly who it was. It was one of the groups of people making those models. That was what they said was a possibility. The idea, if we can keep the rise in temperature to less than 2 degrees, that will maybe be all right into the distant future. That's also based on the models. And the models all have uncertainty in them. So there are nevertheless like 25 different models that different groups are taking, and we have some confidence in what they're predicting. Yes?
Can you just explain about the clouds creating more heat on the Earth?
Yeah, well, a cloud both, on this side, the cloud, the sunlight coming in is just bouncing off. On the other side, the cloud is water vapor. Water vapor turns out to be a very strong greenhouse gas. The only thing is, it's not a greenhouse gas we can do anything about. The amount of water vapor in the air, we have all these oceans, right? Uh-huh. Just depends upon the temperature of the oceans. Again, it's a positive feedback loop, but it's nothing. We can't prevent water vapor from being in the ocean. So the cloud absorbs the energy, and in the same way, it radiates some of it back to the Earth. Some of it lets go. I'm going to be talking about some engineers in California, one at Stanford, one at the University of California, who've written a detailed paper about how we can replace all of our energy needs by renewable energies. And they have state by state, you can get the information as to what would be just right for you. So they've done a great deal of work on this. And I respect their work. They have said something when speaking about the question of suppose you paint your house white. They said, our simulations seem to show that if you do that, the extra radiation is going to cause more clouds. It's going to get worse rather than better. I tend not to believe it. I haven't seen any response to that, really. It seems to me the response to something is very rarely bigger than the something. So if you're sending more radiation out, there may be things that happen that limit that, but I can't believe it would turn it around completely so you wind up worse off than you were before. It indicates, however, the difficulties in this whole area of knowing just what to do, right? Any other questions about it? Did I get it for you? Do you understand it now?
Yeah, the science was a little bit over my head for a lot of years, not really understanding the stuff in the news when they would talk about it and,
But did you have a question about what I said just today?
No.
It seems okay? Okay, good. So let me go back then to where we were. Which was here. Well, I basically said this. This is an interesting figure. This came from the ICCP, the sort of international body of scientists, which is trying to get express clearly what the consensus is about these things so that people can make informed choices about it. And their claim is that by the end of the century, if we don't do anything, 40 to 70% of the species on the planet will become extinct. Now, we already know we're in the largest mass extinction ever, which is just from what we've observed already. This is where it's going to go if we don't do it. I don't hope you're feeling a little bit frightened, but I noticed that I was feeling frightened as I said that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, whoa.
Yeah. Ironic that it's the largest mass extinction since the one that happened around the time that all the carbon fuels started being created in the ground.
There was one which something like 95% of the species died, and most of those were in the ocean at the time. So if we want to retain our civilization, and I don't think the complex civilization we have, you know, poorly run that it is, can survive these kind of stresses. We can't respond to much simpler things, you know. We're going to have to figure out how to resolve this problem. And so what I'm mostly going to talk about are two possibilities. The one I suggested had been well studied by the folks in California, and the one that was well studied by one of my colleagues at the University of Houston. His name is David Criswell. He had a colleague who many years ago, like 30 years ago, they were considering a problem which had been posed to the National Academy and to the Department of Energy, which was, couldn't we capture sunlight on satellites that we put up in orbit and then beam the energy back to places that we need it? That study was done. It's way too expensive. It costs much too much to put these satellites up to get the kind of energy that you need. But in the course of doing it, he had this idea. He and his colleague had this idea. We have a satellite which is up in the air. It's the moon. Furthermore, he worked for 7 years as the person who managed. This was during the Apollo program and the run-up to it, when people were asked the question, if we go to the moon, what can we do there? What use can we make of it? What are we likely to find? What is the materials we'll find there? Well, the Apollo program answered some of that, and there was a large number of papers written on that. And he was basically managing that whole thing, and he got to see all of it. And so he knows very, very well what you can do with the moon, what's there, and what the possibilities of using it are. So those are the two things I want to talk about and just share with you a bit more of what the cost would be. You know, can we really do this? And what some of the possibilities would be if we did do it. So just to give you an idea of where we are, this is our energy consumption now, well, actually 4 years ago, but hadn't changed much. Renewables are 9% of the total. Nuclear power is 8%. I'm sure there's very little interest here in expanding nuclear power. And besides pollution and all that, my objection to it is the capital costs are enormous and it takes too long to do it, and we don't have the time, and we could do much better to put that capital in other things. But the rest of it is all fossil fuels, which are pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, and it comes up to Well, 83% of the total.
Isn't natural gas now getting bigger, coals getting smaller?
I'm sure it is. This is 4 years old. It's probably not completely correct. Electricity is different. So this is total energy consumption. Electricity, renewables a little bit larger fraction. We don't use petroleum much for actually making electricity. Right? We burn it in our cars. But nuclear is 19%, natural gas is 27%, and coal. And this was only in February 2015. Okay. Coal is the most polluting because when you burn coal, everything that comes out is CO2. When you burn natural gas, only half the stuff that comes out is CO2. For every water molecule, you get a CO2 molecule. And the energy comes out from both the carbon and the hydrogen.
Could I ask a question or a comment, though?
Sure.
With the natural gas, though, it's not just the burning of it that's the issue, it's the leakage of the methane.
Okay. Exactly.
That makes it actually worse for the planet because the methane is heating things up quicker than coal.
Natural gas had been justified as, well, this is at least a response to climate change, if we're moving away from coal.
Clean carbon.
Clean coal is a fiction. I had someone who actually represented the coal companies coming by to talk to the physics department at the University of Houston. This was a year and a half ago, talking about the experiments were being done, and they're all being closed down. There will be no clean coal. They hadn't figured out how to do it. It's just a political gimmick. Yes.
I can tell you that in Rite Aid, Mississippi, almost all of the oil fields are being redeveloped specifically for natural gas, not for oil.
Being fracked for it?
Not much fracking in the state at this point, but just going to a different levels.
Going down different places,
deeper, getting gas.
Sniff for me. Why is oil not used to make electricity?
Well, it's cheaper than to use natural gas and coal. There are some oil-burning power plants, but they get converted to natural gas when it becomes cheaper. And so...
question?
Yeah.
Are you... I thought I saw in you, as you were flipping through, I thought I saw a slide that might represent that. Were you going to be talking about the work of David McKay? Sustainable energy without the hot air from...
Yes, I will. It's about two slides from now.
Okay.
David McKay is a professor of physics at Cambridge.
Late.
Did he die?
He died of cancer in April, in the middle of April.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a fast-moving cancer that unfortunately took his life.
Well, he performed a great service with his book.
We'll
see.
Sustainable energy without the hot air.
Right, and it's written so that you can understand, for instance, all the estimates that I'm going to make. It's about the same in the rest of the world. A very small fraction of the total energy consumption is solar and geothermal, or any other renewables. So we're basically talking about replacing almost the entire energy supply of the world in as short a period of time as we can, because we don't really know how long we've got before this runaway process takes over. And at best goes to a new kind of semi-stable point, a new basin of attraction with different patterns and so on. At worst, runs away into Venus. I mean, we don't know. And the models can't really tell you with that much accuracy. At least they haven't tried to claim that they can. So here's some important numbers. There's lots of power available from sunlight. It's 1,000 watts per meter, kilowatt per meter. You know, your house maybe uses 4 or 5 kilowatts, typically. I'm going to talk a little bit later about power coming from the moon in microwave beams. Now those microwave beams are created by us. They're engineered to be a certain level, 200 watts per square meter, which is to say 1/5 the energy of sunlight. If you stood in one, you might feel a little warmth, but you'd probably not notice it. Yes.
Do you have any estimate on how long it might take to engineer a system like
that? I'm going to talk about that, okay. Precisely. The power available from... So this, every square meter, you can get 200 watts beamed down to you from the moon with the plan that David Criswell put together. The power available from photovoltaics on Earth is 5 to 20 watts per square meter. And that's way less. It's way less because the efficiency of the solar cells, 16% is pretty good. So that's already a factor of 5. But also, that's the power available when the sun is right above you. When the sun is over here, you got nothing. And as the sun moves over this way, you lose essentially half of it on average. And of course, there's the other half of the day when there's no sunlight. So that's another factor of 4. Then, of course, there's the intermittency problem. You know, when there are clouds overhead, you don't have any sunlight. There was one period of time when for 6 weeks, the whole western side, western half of the country was covered by clouds. Wind power, you've all seen the turbines, right? This is an estimate which comes directly out of David Mackey, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, is the power available from wind power is 2.2 watts per square meter. Now that's a lot less even than the solar power. And the reason for that is that it's an estimate about how close can you put these things together before they start interacting with each other. Before what you're getting is not the wind from one, but the wind from another, and you know, it's not going to work. So that's an estimate, and he describes this estimate in the book, and I'm just taking it as on face value. He put together a summary table of all the different sources of energy that we were consuming. So cars were 40 kilowatt hours per day. That was his unit, right? You can kind of understand that, right? Yes.
Does that translate into the amount of carbon in the atmosphere?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the more you, exactly right. Exactly right. Jet flights, 30 kilowatt hours per day. A kilowatt hour, by the way, a watt is a unit of power. It's energy per unit time. It's how fast can you expend energy, right? That's what you mean by power. So a kilowatt hour is a unit of energy, right? It's energy per unit time times time. So we could call it other names, but it's a chunk of energy, right? This is what you pay for, right? You pay for kilowatt hours. That's what's on your bill, right? Because that's how much energy we're giving you, right? We don't care how fast you burn it. We don't care when you burn it. What we know is how much of a total did you burn. And that's why we use that. Lights, etc. So it added up to all that stuff on the right. No, on the left, sorry.
What stuff?
Your left.
There's a technical.
All of these things over here, right? These are sources of energy that we're using for these things.
And what's the thing at the top?
What's the thing at the top?
Oh, that's in quote defense.
Oh.
That's how much CO2 is being put into the air by all of our jet planes flying around and our carrier fleets. Now, that was for England, okay? For England, the Defense Department was putting in 4 kilowatt.
Per
day. Kilowatt hours per day.
That third one down that just says stuff?
Yeah, it's manufacturing the car, manufacturing your toaster, manufacturing your TV. All the various manufacturing things that go on, you have to produce stuff. That's what he meant.
And that's our houses too?
Yeah, producing your house too, for instance, yeah.
No, I mean when we heat our house.
Separate category.
That's here.
Oh,
that's heating and cooling.
Okay.
Your house and office buildings and everything else, yes.
Wouldn't the defense section be much larger for the U.S.?
Yes.
Yes.
It's larger, but I don't think it's the predominant thing. I mean, just going by the, you know, in comparison of their total defense budget and our total defense budget, it's about a quarter of what ours is. So maybe ours is four times that.
But,
significant contribution, but not as big as, for instance, heating houses.
But as a relative contribution to that column, while the Defense Department is certainly a bigger total kilowatt hours than they have, we have more cars per capita.
That's
than
true
they
too.
Have. We have a lot of other sources of domestic energy consumption proportionally than they do. So the Defense Department may not be any bigger as a relative proportion. It might even be smaller.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, neither. I don't have certainty, but I mean, yes, our Defense Department is bigger than there, but we have more cars per capita than we do. We have a lot of other things. In our houses are bigger. We heat more cubic meters of air, you know, in the winter than they do. There's a lot of other things that affect that calculation. It's not as straightforward as ours is bigger than theirs.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, in terms of CO2 put into the air, there's no question that ours is bigger.
Yeah.
And I would say it's about four times as much, just based on the amount spent.
Okay.
As a percentage, it might not be that much.
Many people say that the Pentagon is the largest consumer of fossil fuels in the world.
That's probably right.
Okay.
Yeah. So he did that. He said, well, that looks pretty good. Well, let me put it back. We have all these ways of doing it. There's no reason to put your eggs in one basket. We have lots of different ways of using renewable energy. There's wind power, right? With the turbines, you know, in somebody's backyard. There's solar heating. You can just put a panel with water flowing through it on your roof, circulate it through your house, and you can heat your house that way in the winter. Photovoltaic farms, you've seen these, right? Big fields of photovoltaics, directly converting sunlight into electrical energy, biomass, all of the other things that, you know, grow and we burn them, but it's not a net production of carbon, because the thing that we're growing sequestered the carbon in real time, in our time, right? Not 100 million years ago, it did it now. And so that's a sort of, it's a wash. It doesn't cost you anything, and it does give you energy. You can put them offshore. You can put them way offshore. You can use waves. You know, you put something on the ocean that floats, it goes up and down, and you can use that motion to generate electricity. Tides, the same thing. You know, huge rushes of water in and out. Some of that is already being done. This is not, all of this stuff exists. Geothermal, if you happen to be sitting on top of a volcano, like in Iceland, for instance, you can run a pipe down there and get some heat out.
Actually,
heat your house with it.
Actually, you can do it anywhere. I'm putting it in right now in northern Michigan.
It's a heat sink.
Yeah.
It's a heat pump. And yes, you can, and it's efficient. And it's worth doing. If you go down far enough in the ground, the temperature will be something like, I don't know, 55 degrees, something like that. What was it that
they 55 degrees.
55 degrees, right? So, in the summertime, no problem. Just blow some air down there. It gets cooled, you blow it back into your house. You've got an air conditioning, of course, you're just blowing, right? You don't have to be pumping liquids around or doing anything else, really. It's very expensive. In the winter, right, you have to do some work in order to get the air hotter. But it's easier to do the work when you're starting with 55 degrees than when you're starting with, for instance, 0 degrees outside. So it's I think in probably most situations it's economical and worth doing, yeah.
I own property as acreage, and half of my property is underwater. It's a great big thermal heat sink that I wanted to tap into. The reason I didn't, it was too much upfront cost.
That's the problem. And we're going to see that that's the problem also with a lot of the solutions, is that the upfront cost is really high, at least at the moment. And I'll talk about that in just a second. Yes.
I have a friend who wrote a book about this, which I didn't quite understand, but one major point she made was about agriculture, that because there's so much agribusiness, the soil, they degrade the soil. So the soil is supposed to hold in the carbon. So the effect of the agribusiness is much bigger than people know, because they're not holding in the carbon.
Yeah, you use chemical fertilizers to get things to grow rather than use carbon sequestered by microbes which are growing in the soil. I wish I could remember the name of the book. Perhaps you do.
It's called The Biochar Solution. Maybe that's not the book.
But that's the idea, by reconditioning the soil, you not only increase its productivity without fertilizers, and they claim up to the level of what the fertilizers can do. So they say that this green revolution, which was a result of extensive use of fertilizers, the productivity can be matched by natural agriculture which makes use of normally existing biological stuff in the ground, and it will sequester. The figure that I saw was within a year, you could sequester essentially everything that was being produced by the United States with an amount of land that was kind of reasonable to do it. Because you have to do that year after year after year, and you can't do that. So it's not entirely a solution for the long run, but I think certainly as part of a solution, it's a good idea.
Yeah.
So that's it. This was his estimate of what you could actually do physically, right? I mean, you got to put wind farms in England. Well, there's only so much space in England, and you got to put them a certain distance apart. That means you know, that's how much you can do. What happened?
It looks in and out for some reason.
Good.
That's
okay.
An energy problem.
Instability problem. I think I may be hitting this with my hand.
I think it's
going to
be the table shape.
It shouldn't be that touch.
Oh, dear me.
It shouldn't be that sensitive.
Can I add to that last comment?
Sure.
You were saying you have to do that year after year, and that could be true. Some people have said one factor or element or catalyst would be something called biochar, because it has the ability to store carbon in the soil for thousands of years, as opposed to the normal carbon cycle, which is, I don't know, whatever it is. So it's just, that's an element in this paper that I'm introducing, and it's just one factor.
So it looks pretty good, right? With renewables, you can replace the entire energy balance. All of these other things that use fossil fuels, you can replace it with renewables. However, people don't want to see England covered with wind farms as close together as they can be. And so if you take into account what people are actually likely to be willing to do, I mean, offshore, you know, shallow offshore wind, remember what happened in Cape Cod? Those folks out there are quite wealthy. They didn't want to see the wind farms out there, spoiled their view. And Teddy Kennedy went and saw to it that didn't happen, right? So the political difficulties of getting any of this done are enormous. He cites some of the others. The photovoltaic farms, they are too expensive. I mean, if you want to go and put photovoltaic stuff on your roof now, it's going to cost you about $20,000. And the payoff, I've seen various figures, but it's at least 7 or 8 years, maybe more like 20.
It depends on the rate of electricity. So if you're in Houston, it's not a great payoff. But if you're in an expensive city where electricity is expensive, it's a bad payoff.
Right. I'm afraid to touch this thing now. Anyway, that's what he says you could plausibly do, which is to say you can't solve the problem that way. And he sort of ends his book in saying, you know, help those folks who have lots of expanse, you know, like the Sahara Desert or like the Western United States, will come up with some way of making use of that land in order to do these kinds of things. Yes?
So, summarizing one other thing you're sort of saying in his book, the issue with the wind farms, tide farms, photovoltaic, is it takes country-sized footprints to generate enough. In his original analysis, it takes country-sized footprints to generate enough energy for everybody if you space them far enough apart. And there is the not in my backyard NIMBY phenomenon.
Yep.
So it's going to take a political will to change those considerations, or the technology has to get better and more efficient than it currently is.
Yes.
Or it has to be a smaller scale. Like the lady here, she could put her coils to capture that energy out of her septic tank or something like that pretty cheaply.
What I'm going to show you is the solution that's been put forth by Mark Jacobson and Mark DeLucci. Jacobson is an engineering professor at Stanford, and DeLucci is an engineering professor, I think, at the University of California. This was a few years ago, and it's made quite a stir. It's got 258 references in the literature. So people are paying attention to this. And they tried to think, what do we have to do to replace the entire energy budget of the planet, which right now is about 17 terawatts? Well, terawatt is 1,000 gigawatts. A gigawatt is 1,000 billion watts. is that right? No, I'm sorry.
Megawatts.
I'm sorry, 1,000 megawatts. So it's 10 to the 12th. It's a million watts, right? That's the energy consumption that you have to replace.
Or do we have to?
Well
energy conservation.
If you want to keep something like our civilization going, some people don't want to.
But I meant as far as wasteful, energy conservation.
You can certainly do. You can certainly do a great deal with conservation, and. I'll talk more about that.
Okay.
What does this actually get you? Okay. But,
recycling.
I don't know.
Maybe the back connections messed up.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just not tight. So, this is what they say you need. Okay? This could be distributed throughout the world. 3,800,000 5-megawatt wind turbines. So, that's a pretty big wind turbine, but it's something which exists. 49,300 megawatt concentrated solar plants. Now, what that is you have mirrors over a large area, and they reflect sunlight to a central tower where you have something in the tower that can be melted with the heat. That's...
solar thermal?
Yeah, that's solar thermal. These exist. Actually, the University of Houston created one in California. They work, and you can estimate how many of those you need. Now, one of the things that's involved in this is trying to get priorities: wind versus solar thermal versus photovoltaic. Right? You can also do the kind of thing you have on your roof, which is a panel which converts sunlight directly into electricity. You could have a big field of those. So that's 40,300 megawatt solar photovoltaic power plants. Now, a 300 megawatt plant is a pretty big power plant. 100 megawatts is sort of standard, for city-sized things. So those are big plants. 1.7 billion, that's billion, 3 kilowatt, this is your rooftop thing, right? People can do that. And then there's some smaller numbers of geothermal power plants. There's not too many places you can do that. 270 new 1,300. You couldn't do anything. What's going on here?
I don't know.
It may have been on too long, but I can't do anything about that. And then 490,000 1 megawatt tidal effect. So a lot of places where you could put small 1 megawatt tidal things in. So they're going to use all of this. This is their suggestion, okay, as to how we can do it. This is replacing all of the energy with electrical energy. Electrical energy is much more useful than the energy you get from fossil fuels. It takes out of the energy in a gallon of gasoline, if you wanted to use it to produce electricity, you get one third the energy that way that you would get by just burning it from the thermal energy that you can get. It's a very efficient form of energy. These things are giving it to you directly. You don't have to burn anything to get it. That's the whole point. And it's also, it turns out, the prosperity of a society, once they get past a certain point, is almost directly proportional to how much electricity they consume. So this next table basically summarizes the costs and the amount of power generated. And these things do the same thing. So as you can see, their mix is mostly wind in terms of power generation. This is concentrated solar thermal. The yellow is the solar photovoltaic tank. The homes are the purplish. You see, it's not really a big factor. We're not going to be able to do this by everybody put up a thing on their roof. It's not efficient. The use of resources is not. It's not efficient. You should be putting it into other things. What about the cost?
I'm not clear on that point. Why is it not efficient to do a lot of rooftops?
Well, because the material that you have to use to do it, and the amount of energy that you get out of it. It isn't as good as, for instance, you put them all in a field together, where they were linked together, where they had where the infrastructure holding them was set up to do many, many at a time. It wasn't your roof. You didn't have to put special things on your roof to do it. It's also that the houses are distributed in all kinds of places with all kinds of conditions. You would put these other plants out in the desert where the sunlight is more likely to be there. Yes.
Does that take into consideration losses through transmission over these long?
I believe it does. I believe it does. I'm not quite sure.
It sounds like you're basically saying it's economic efficiency. Pick the most optimal site and use the best available technology to get the most bang for your buck. You're not going to get it on a small scale.
That's right. And your question is, but if you do that, you have transmission costs. And I'm not sure how carefully they calculated that. Yes?
I'm just very confused because right now, how many poor people do we have that forget about doing any of this, right?
I want to get to that. I want to get to that. The cost to do this is between these two figures. This is the figure for what they cost. I mean, you hear that solar cells are coming down in price, which is true. What they're suggesting is for 15 years, don't build any new fossil fuel plants. Everything that goes in has to be renewable, some mix of these things. At the end of 15 years, start phasing out all the fossil fuel plants. The cost at the end of that time, if you had done the whole thing with the cost of what it would be at the end, that would be what they, this is their calculation, not mine, $36 trillion. Okay? $36 trillion. Now, the U.S. budget, I think, is $11 trillion. And that's over a period of 30 years or so.
The annual world economic output is just shy of $30 trillion.
Right. So we're talking about a major investment, which was what you were saying is... $30 trillion? I haven't even got $100. What are you talking about?
And my job's going overseas.
Right. So somewhere between those two figures, the $72 trillion would be the cost of doing it with with what it would cost today, if you bought it for the price it was in 2008. All right. So what I want to show you now, and I haven't got much time, and I want to get clear the possibilities of this other method of doing things. As I said earlier, is get the energy production out of the ecosystem altogether. Put it on the moon. Remember, don't think werewolves. Sunlight there is completely predictable. There's no atmosphere, there's no clouds, there's no nothing. You know exactly how much sunlight's going to be there. You collect it on the moon, I'll show you in a minute just how you do that, and you beam it back to the Earth. You can beam it back directly to where the, you know, some of the Earth, half the Earth is always facing the moon. The moon is always facing the Earth, so it's, you know, it's always sort of able to beam things back. But for where it's on the backside of the Earth, you can put satellites up to redirect the beam to where you need it. So this would be the fully mature lunar solar power project. The energy is essentially expandable as far as you want on the moon. The moon gets 13,000 terawatts of power all the time to be captured. We need 1/600th of that. So the energy is there. Question is, how do you get it? How do you do it? Well, as I say, that's what Dave Criswell spent a lot of time thinking about and planning and writing proposals about. You basically send up some machinery to produce some habitation, which is this little hut over here in the top, says number 6. Set up some machines like this, which can move along the moon's surface, collecting the material on the surface and producing solar panels. Solar panels, the cheapest ones, are essentially sand. And they're silicon. They're amorphous silicon. The moon is mostly silicon.
Manufacture them there?
What's that?
Manufacture them there?
You manufacture it there. That's right. That's right. The cost is only, the cost of the ecosystem is only to get the machinery up there. And I'll show you in a minute how little machinery you have to get up there to do it. So the solar panels are actually over here. There's pairs of them on both sides of the moon, so one or the other of them is always producing power. And then you have a microwave transmitter, which is basically like what's in your microwave oven. It's really no different. All of this is easily available technology. It was available in 1980. And you reflect it off, the beam of microwaves is reflected off of this panel, which is also basically a silica panel, just used to reflect for microwaves. These panels are put in a shape so that it forms a lens. There are many, many, many of them. And the lens focuses the beam back onto the Earth, onto areas like about 400 meters in diameter. And this is a picture of, you know, it's an artist's picture of one. These are called rectennas. So what they do is they take the microwaves, which are coming down, and they convert them into DC electricity, which you can then convert into AC electricity. The rectenna itself looks like chicken wire up on poles. The chicken wires are actually diodes, and when the radiation hits them, they produce constant stream of electricity. Yes.
Oh, I mean, with respect to the Earth, the moon isn't stationary, right? It moves around the Earth. So how do you?
It moves around the Earth, but it's always keeping the same face to the Earth.
Yeah, but this would be in one point on the Earth, right? So how would you make sure those microwaves would hit that spot?
Well, you can control the beams.
Okay.
These are called phased array radars. And they don't, it's a radar, you know, you've seen radars where the thing is moving.
Right.
That's no longer the way radars are made.
How would this work?
You control the electrical signals in different parts of the antenna.
Okay.
So in this case, these individual ones, the phase of the signal from the microwaves can be adjusted for every single one of these. You can then take a beam and you can sweep it like that just by changing the phase between two of them.
All right.
if you're hip to this sort of stuff, if you have two radiators and you change the phase of them, you can make the beam go that way or straight ahead if the phase is the same, or that way. You can do that. Basically, it's a programming problem. It's not a problem. There are military devices like this that have been running for 40 years, right. Essentially uninterrupted, yes.
I apologize, I have to leave for interrupting you, but two things. Do you mind if I ask if anybody wants a paper on restorative agriculture? And two, to throw a monkey wrench into all this, what do you think about
You can't get up and leave and throw in a monkey wrench.
I know. I wish I could be here for this. But, for example, cold fusion has been debunked, but on the other hand, other people say there's something there. And I know standard science doesn't buy it, so I just get your reaction.
I'm a standard scientist.
Yes, so I would have a reaction. Yes. Otherwise, do you mind if on my way out I ask anybody wants this paper?
So put your hand up on his way out.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So there's lots of advantages to this. And one of them is essentially unlimited amounts of electricity, which you can use, for instance, to split water into hydrogen and oxygen and run a hydrogen economy with, so you don't have to run your cars with gasoline, which you can use to pull carbon dioxide out of the air. If you have energy, you can reverse that process. If you have energy which doesn't cost you heat on the planet, you can reverse that process.
How much of the total energy that's available to tap on the moon, how does that compare to our energy budget we use now? Do we need it all just in there?
Insignificant. One 600th of the total. I mean, it's, you know, forget about it.
Could you explain that again?
The amount of solar energy available on the moon is 600 times the energy that we need here. The 17 terawatts of power that we need. 600 times.
So you need infrastructure covering 1/600th of the face of the moon in order to meet the...
Yeah, basically that's right.
But is there a time limit on that? Or, is that like ongoing? It's always that
Here's the idea. You do a pilot project on the moon, which would take about between 10 and 15 years, is Chris Rohl's estimate, which produces 1 terawatt of electrical power beamed back to the Earth. 1 terawatt of electrical power is what the electrical energy consumption of the United States is. So you can sell that on the planet for 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which is what you're paying for it now. And you can pay for, actually in both of these schemes, you're paying for the development by the power that you're generating. You can pay for the development of the rest of the electrical energy you need, which is 20 times that, actually, in Criswell's estimate, 17 times that in the California engineer's estimate, by selling the energy, essentially. And you will bootstrap up within another 15 years. You'll have all the energy you can need, and furthermore, you'll have all the energy you could ever conceivably need. You could also have a colony on the moon, which is engaged in production and using the energy for its own purposes. One of the things that I think people have, it's difficult to grasp, is how key energy is to all of this, to all of civilization. If you've got this available, you can do anything. Well, anything we've thought of so far, yeah.
Who's gonna own?
Yes.
That's
I'll own it.
So let me answer it now, though. In order for this to happen, actually, I think in order for any of these things to happen, we have to get beyond the politics of nation states and conflict over resources. I mean, one of the things that this says is we don't need to be fighting over resources. We don't need to be fighting over energy. It is available if we would get together and agree to do it. Now, clearly, you don't want one country controlling the power source of the world.
No.
Nothing. So this requires a political transformation to happen, but it can also encourage a political transformation. If you've got a goal like this, which is possible, people say, maybe we don't have to send Marines over, you know, troops over to the Middle East to keep on taking their oil. Yeah.
But I don't think it's the country itself that is going to stop this.
It's the elites that own.
Let me try to get to the politics in just a bit, okay? And they have to live on this planet too, and I don't think they want to see a Venus solution either. I mean, you have to give the, you have to give the elites some credit for being human beings at some level. How many people are willing to do that? Please put your hand up if you're willing to do that. Okay.
Everyone's human.
It's clearly an issue. It's clearly an issue.
They really are suicidal.
They're not right by the humans.
The cost of doing that first stage, according to Criswell, and he calculated it with the same systems that we used to calculate this thing earlier where you're putting up satellites from the Earth, is about $1 trillion over 15 years. It'll produce electricity at 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And at the end of this process, you'll produce electricity at 1 cent a kilowatt hour. According to Jacobson and DeLucci, the cost of doing that would be on the Earth would be five times as large, $5 trillion. At the end of that 15 years, you'd be producing electricity at 20 cents a kilowatt hour. And when you finished replacing everything by photovoltaics and whatever, other renewables, it would go back down to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. The air you would need for the whole world, this is, right? This is for the energy for the world, not just the United States, would be Texas, Pennsylvania, and New Mexico. That's the area, from their calculations. The area you would need on the planet for the lunar solar power, which is just these rectennas, is 10% of that at the worst, probably more like 5% of that. But
what was the three states? What did the three states represent?
How much area you would need for solar and wind?
Okay.
In order to be able to produce that much energy, so Texas, Pennsylvania, and New Mexico. Now, why is it so much cheaper to do it on the moon? And this is a really surprising slide. It surprised me when I saw it. I could hardly believe it. This is how much mass do you have to move in order to produce a terawatt of electricity for 1 year? Okay? So it figured into this is the lifetime of these various different technologies. As you see, the cost of putting the machinery on the moon to produce it is insignificant. The actual mass of the base camps is insignificant. The rectennas on the planet are also insignificant. The poles holding up the rectennas turned out to be more mass than the rectennas themselves. A coal plant, its mines and trains, that's not the coal, it's just the infrastructure of the coal plant, requires that much. A light water nucleate reactor requires that much. Again, why the capital costs are higher. The Grand Coulee Dam requires that much. So that's in tons per terawatt electric year. And the Earth photovoltaics is much more than any of them, and that's a Department of Energy calculation. For a solar thermal system, which they calculated, I'm sorry, it's photovoltaic system, the 16.5% efficient, 2 hours of storage batteries, I didn't mention it, but the sun doesn't shine all the time and you don't know when it's gonna shine. So if you wanna have your hospital's got power all the time, you might think you have to have some kind of storage, so they chose batteries, okay? Huge amounts of mass. It seems like an ephemeral thing, but in fact, in terms of the mass that you have to use, it's actually much greater than even these other things. I mean, the Grand Coulee Dam, who, you know, when you think of massive, that's it, right? Even so. So, just to finish, we've only got about 5 minutes, there's a way to get there from here that doesn't require that you do the whole system immediately. At present, what we have is you dig up the coal somewhere, you send it on a train somewhere, you put it, you know, you produce power, and then you send it off. What you could do is the stage of this project where you're beaming microwaves up to a satellite and then beaming it back. In what I showed you before, it was coming directly from the moon. It could be coming from this place where you're digging up the the materials, where you're mining the materials, where you're producing the oil, it could even be coming from a place where the sun was still shining. You beam it up to a satellite and you beam it back to where you want. And the satellites and the whole system can be adjusted so you can beam it back to many different places. In other words, it replaces transmission lines, you know, copper, holes, with microwave beams and a satellite. And you can use it to distribute the energy. You could try out the technology with this. I'm told, I don't know for sure, that the cost, the energy cost of bringing energy in from West Texas, where there is wind power being produced, Green Mountain Energy, which is actually BP, is beaming power back. You know, it's not beaming anything. It's the transmission lines getting the power back to Houston eat up 80% of the energy. That's what I'm told by. This is my colleague who's actually the chairman of the department. Usually knows what he's talking about.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
The transmission lines from the wind power in West Texas eat up 80%.
That's what he said. That seems like a large figure to me, and I haven't had a chance.
That's kind of what I was getting at before when you talked about the centralized plants that can go into the individual houses, etc. Lose a lot of electricity there.
Yeah. Yeah, and as I say, I haven't had a chance to really look at it carefully and find out what the real figures are. This sort of thing would be about 85% efficient. You have some losses in the conversion to microwaves, you have some losses in the reflection, and you have some losses in the conversion to energy over here, but it's probably around 85%. Even if that was equivalent to a transmission line, what you can do with this, which you can't do with transmission lines, is you can beam it where you want. And so it could be as part of a, and again, this is where we need to think about possibilities. It could be as part of developing the energy sources on the planet with photovoltaic cells somewhere. But if you've got multiple ones and the sun's not shining over here, it's probably shining somewhere. You know, you have the possibility of transferring power without it having to be directly connected with hardwired power lines. So this could be a way to get there from here. My conclusions are, I didn't show you all those. I didn't show you that slide at all, did I? No wonder you're looking at me puzzled. So the oil comes out here, or the coal, you produce the electricity, and then you beam it wherever you want, basically. Saving on the transmission costs.
That slide is about a transition period
where
you're using oil.
Yeah, we can certainly put the satellites up. We can certainly produce the microwave beams. We can certainly do the rectenners. We can see, for instance, if we can stably do it, if you can keep it focused on the satellite well enough so that it stays focused on the rectenner. What are the actual losses? What is the sort of engineering exploration that needs to be done? Because after all, one of the disadvantages of a lunar solar power project is you don't have a lot of experience. You have a lot of experience with the individual pieces. You don't have a lot of experience with a system like that. And that's always an issue. The payback is, in 45 years, you could have a planet where everyone has the same kind of prosperity that we have. Even those people who don't have any energy right now, 1.5 billion people have no electricity. You know, what are their lives like with no electricity? Well, they may be very lovely lives, but they're not surviving very long, and it's a very difficult life. This thing is easily expandable. All you have to do is redirect the beam. All it has to be built in an area which wants the electricity is one of these rectenners, and they're very cheap. Doesn't cost much, doesn't move much mass, it's not difficult. The technology that goes into producing the system would be provided by the industrialized world, and the beams could then be used to bring along all those people who aren't coming along now, who don't really have a future, even in the plan of Jacobson and DeLucci. for reasons someone more pointed out, you pointed out, they can't afford any of this. They can't afford wind farms, they can't afford photovoltaic things, they can't afford what's cheaper now, which is fossil fuel produced stuff, right? So, and if you want them to come along, and you want them not to use fossil fuels, you've got to give them something. This is a way of giving it to them very cheaply. You know, 1 cent a kilowatt hour probably can be afforded by most places in the world. So that's the vision of it. And I guess I'm going to stop there.
Can you give references to where this is written up and how can we read more about it? What scientists are working on it? Where is it being published?
I can, but how should I give them to you?
Google. Tell them what
you're
Google. David Criswell.
Yeah.
This is all written up by David Criswell?
Yeah. If you have access to a library.
Sure.
D.R. Criswell, C-R-I-S-W-E-L-L. Just Google his name. A lot of this stuff will come up. Some of it are conference proceedings. Some of it is our papers that have been written in journals and so on.
I see some huge spin-off benefits from this project. For example, if you start moving a lot of your manufacturing and mining to the moon, you've got a gravity well that's a small fraction of the Earth's moon stuff into the system to start expanding all over the universe.
I don't know how about getting to the next star. That's really a leap. But in terms of exploring the universe, yes, it would be a great value. Yes.
How many of these facilities does he envision on the moon? Because it seems to me you'd need an array from one side of the moon to the other, including the wobble zone, because otherwise you can have short periods where you have completely zero power, unless you're in the small portion, the 6% that gets...
You see these dots over here? That's kind of what he's envisioning, and that's kind of the size of what he's talking about.
So there's got to be hundreds of them, so you don't have a blackout on Earth.
Yeah, thousands of them, yeah.
It's hard to position. And did he consider the relative cost of that versus low Earth orbit or geosynchronous?
Yeah, that's how he got started. The stuff with geosynchronous orbit, you've got to bring all of that mass up there. You've got to have the mass of the satellite and the mass of the solar cells. And you have to have so much of it. But here, the mass is all on the moon already. You don't need it. You know, you're going to produce it out of the material of the moon. It was precisely that juxtaposition that led him to this idea.
And just a historic aside, Isaac Asimov predicted this in 1956.
Really?
That it would come to pass in 2061.
That's crazy.
What was the name of the
story? Was called The Last Question.
The Last Question.
A little scientific aside to the storyline.
Got it.
That a world with orbit solar power would come to pass in 2061.
Okay. Bob?
Well, my take on this is to make steel, they take iron ore. They throw in coke with it. They have to melt the ore.
Yeah.
They throw in scrap iron, too. It takes an enormous amount of energy to do that. Second thing is, so we live in an industrial society. Machines have moving parts. Those moving parts generate friction, and to dissipate the heat from that friction and keep the, for instance, the axles from melting the bearings, we use petroleum. The reason that we use petroleum is that the boiling point is sufficiently high so that the heat generated by the friction does not destroy the petroleum. I don't believe there are any plant-based oils with a high enough
boiling point to allow that. And so I have a hard time seeing ever replacing fossil fuels. You can talk about decreasing it a certain amount, but to make steel with the
you need heat to make steel. You could do it.
You need massive amounts of heat.
You could, if you have the electricity, and there are some steel processes which actually work on electricity. Mm-hmm. They don't use. You're talking about an open hearth process. Yeah. There are processes which actually just use electricity going through this collection of ore and coke and whatever else to melt the thing.
But
it exists already.
Again, they use fossil fuels to generate that electricity.
Well, but the point is that we're going to use. That you have to get away from it. You don't have a choice. One. Second, this is actually possible. These numbers aren't cooked up out of thin air. We know we can make photovoltaics. We know how much energy we get out of them. We know how much sunlight there is. This is not airy fairy.
So you should look into an electric arc furnace. It generates more heat than the surface of the sun, and that's just through electricity. Now the question is where you get that electricity from. You could use solar. You could use fossil fuels, you could burn coal, you know. It's about making the right choices about the source of the electricity, not so much. Does that make sense?
You had a question.
Yeah, you can't quit without talking about the politics. And
talk about what?
The politics. The politics.
Yes, yes.
Okay, and I am a Green, and I have had the idea that being Green had something to do with decentralization. Decentralization of political power and also agriculture and power generation. Now you're making me think that maybe this was just some hippy-dippy idea that we're all going to go off the grid, but you couldn't get much more centralized than this. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And it's essential that this central power facility, I mean, the sun is a central power facility, really, right? We all get our energy from the sun. It's a central thing, right? So that's not really the issue. The issue is control of this. In order for it to happen, you're going to have a political transformation where people begin to recognize themselves in the other. They begin to recognize in the necessity of working together. Of, you know, adopting a principle of, you know, we're all here together on this planet. We should all somehow have equal benefit out of the work that we do here. We should maybe try to figure out a way to do that. And in this case, we also maybe try to figure out a way to survive together. Because to go ahead and just simply say, well, I'm going to, you know, keep my cars running and my electricity running with fossil fuels. That's guaranteed death. I mean, it is. It's death for civilization. There's no question about it. It's just a question of time, and it isn't long. So I think that motivated by survival of the species, we might actually be willing to cooperate, which is also a green position. You look puzzled, though. You would say, don't you?
No, I'm just trying to imagine grassroots control. Such an enormously centralized
system. Well, somebody
system.
Wants to own the moon anyway. They're already trying to figure out how to buy it.
It wouldn't be hard to implement it technically.
Someone may already own it.
The thing itself is actually distributed. There are thousands of generators on the moon. You could have some people controlling some of them, whatever. I mean, it's a political problem, but I think it's the central political problem of our time. Is how do we get beyond what works for me and my nation and begin to really see that in order for us to survive together, we have to take care of each other. We have to look out for each other's interests. The fellow in the back, anybody who hasn't asked the question at all yet, first.
I'll catch you later.
Then let me get your name, Stan. Your name is? Your name?
Me?
No, Ariel, I know your name. Your name.
Oh, my name?
My name?
Well, yours too.
Yeah, I'm Sheldon Schaefer.
Sheldon, and you are?
I'm Ann Garrison. I'm staying at your house.
Oh, Ann, hello. We haven't met yet. And,
so he's been out of town while I've been staying at his house.
Oh. Sheldon, you had a question? And I'll get
I was just going to say that somebody asked about the website. It's lunarsolarpower.org. But I also see that he's from the University of Houston.
Yes.
Is he still here or did he retire?
He retired.
Okay.
He's Professor Emeritus.
What is your estimate of the time that we have till we reach a quote-unquote catastrophic situation?
Between 10 and 35 years, something like that.
That's close. And your estimate for this system was 15 for the pilot?
This could be produced within 10 to 15 years, you can put the pilot project up. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And your name is?
Sue Peters.
Sue Peters. And your name is?
Walter Horton.
Walter? Sue?
Who owns the patents to this?
Dave Criswell.
Dave Criswell.
Let me say, he's been trying to get the government interested in this for 35 years, and he only patented this stuff in the last few years. And he's getting older, and I think he wants to make sure at some point he has some control over what happens.
Yeah. Is there a risk of this being weaponized?
Yes. Again, the control has to be.
That would be really, if you had a hacker and aimless.
That's scary.
Well, it would take more than just a hacker.
Kind of funding
yeah, I know, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, if you rig the phases so that the beam all went one place, yes, you could burn a hole in people.
Yep.
You could
do
it.
Wow. I'll give you another problem. In 1970, 72, on Earth Day, Paul Ehrlich had just written
the population bomb. Yeah.
And the population of the Earth was about 4.3 billion.
Yes.
That it's 7 billion now.
Yes.
And in increasing exponentially.
I don't think it's exponential.
And the question is, how much population can the world sustain?
Well, Criswell figured at 20 terawatts, and 10 billion people, that's 2 kilowatts per person on the planet. People in the United States use 2.8 kilowatts. So basically you're providing electrical energy at a scale pretty comparable to us. You could have a life pretty comparable to ours. And it's been clear for a long, long time that when people are prosperous, when they don't have to worry about their children dying, the birth rate just drops off. And much of Europe, the birth rate is actually negative, and people really are. It's not really a problem. It's been this, and it's also a question about consumption of resources. The 5% of the Earth's population who lives in the United States consumes, I think, 20% of the Earth's resources. So, you have to count us as 5 people. So if you want to talk about limiting population, well, some of us should probably. Yes.
I was just going to ask about the population of like India. More of what we want.